Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The red heifers are being prepared more later. And who was that cool black dude, soft shoes shuffling up Downing Street last week? And why was he there? And why is not a single British journalist remotely interested in why he was there? The United States government is working hard, might and main, to work out how a boat managed to hit the pillar, the prop of a bridge in Baltimore, but has not yet been able to ascertain what exactly happened and why, but was able to tell us within hours of the mass murder in a theater in Moscow exactly who did it and who didn't do it. And why did Rishi Sunak take away my mantle as the greatest threat to British democracy and hand it to the Chinese? Ah, the ignominy of it. Stay tuned. This is really going to be the mother of all talk shows.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
But first, kapow! The British government just gave £1.5 billion of your money to Ukraine. That's not my graphic, that's their graphic. The British government published that graphic today, imagining that there would be much rejoicing in the land amongst the people who've just endured a long, cold, wet, and for many, hungry winter are supposed to rejoice that the British government gave away £1.5 billion of their money to the Zelensky regime in Kiev. And they're so proud of it, the Foreign Office website is topped with not make Britain great, not Britain first, not we're working for you. No, it's in a foreign language. Slava Ukraina. Above that graphic, straight out of a comic, a action hero, action man comic. This shows you how out of touch the British government and the teat-sucking suckers in the British media who live on what comes out of that teat really are. They imagined that in a country where people choose between heating and eating, where pensioners are in poverty, where fuel poverty is everywhere, where millions of our children are living in official poverty in Britain, where workers are on low wages, suppressed year after year after year, where prices are rising, where interest rates are crippling, where energy costs are backbreaking, that in such a country, people will be glad that David Cameron, Lord Snooty, the unelected Secretary of State for Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs in Britain, gave away all that money that belonged to them. Can you imagine what could have been done just with this latest tranche of £1.5 billion? How many potholes could have been filled in? How many people could have been kept warm? How many youth clubs could have been reopened, all shuttered up all over the land? How many community facilities? How many public buildings? How much of the public realm? How much of the National Health Service could have been restored, saved, as a result of that £1.5 billion? But you gave it to Zelensky. Now, not you directly, but the politicians you elected directly gave it. And those politicians do this because they think that you'll go on voting for them anyway. The Uni Party, the two cheeks of that clenched buttock that is the British political system, they think that they can spend our money on war after war after war, war in the Red Sea, war in the Persian Gulf, war in the South China Sea, war in the Ukraine. They think that you will go on allowing them to write these checks, to send these assets that could be guarding our own coasts, but are in fact guarding and threatening other people's coasts. They think that you will continue to vote for them, setting fire to other people's countries whilst unable to keep our own pensioners warm in the winter time. And it's down to you. If you keep electing them, they will, of course, continue to do what they have always done. It's the definition of madness to believe that doing the same thing over and over again may lead to a different result. Einstein, not me. Now, we have so much to talk about tonight. I must press on. Who was that black guy padding up Downing Street, soft shoes shuffling in his suede loafers just the other day? I recognized them immediately as the chefless Barack Obama. Bathhouse Barry, they used to call him in Chicago. I recognized them immediately, but none of the British media appear remotely concerned about why, unannounced and unexplained, the former president of the United States of America was meeting political and security officials inside number 10 Downing Street. I'm very worried about it. Last time Barry came to Britain, it was to interfere in our Brexit referendum. You may recall. He gave a speech written in Britain because it said, if we vote for Brexit, we'll be at the back of the queue for a trade deal with the United States of America. And Americans famously don't use the word queue. He was uttering a statement speech written in London, but he'd been drafted in because the stakes were high. And as many people believe, I'm one of them, that he is actually the Wizard of Oz who runs the Biden administration. All the signs to me are that Biden is not fully in control, even of his own bowel movements, never mind a nuclear-armed superpower, the mightiest country in the world. So somebody must be running the country, and I believe that somebody is Barack Obama. So why was he here? And more importantly, why does not one single British journalist give a toss about why he was here? I'm going to hazard a guess as to why he was here. I'm going to say it had something to do with Ukraine, or it had something to do with the Israel-Palestine conflict, or it had something to do with the conflict between the West, not NATO, because most of the NATO countries have bailed out of this one, the conflict in the Red Sea against the poor but brave people of Yemen. It was one of those things. He didn't come to sing, croon Sam Cooke at them. He came on an errand, on a mission. And it is a sign of the sunken depravity of what passes for journalism in Britain today that not a single British journalist has attempted to find out why Obama was here. The examples of that depravity are so numerous, I literally could run the whole show just adumbrating them. We had another one today. This pervert, I'd never heard of him, this pervert P. Diddy. The feds raided his house in Florida. He's on the lam, apparently, in his private jet. I don't know what he's being accused of beyond that it's some kind of, some class of depravity or other. I've no idea if the allegations against them are true or not. I just know that he's run away to try and avoid justice and the feds. What I do know is that I saw a picture in the British press today where this pervert, P. Diddy, is pictured with his arm around Ginger, Prince Harry. And Harry's in the frame. He's not actually in the story in any way. He's not in the charges, if there are to be any. He's not alleged to have done anything wrong. He was just once in a frame with P. Diddy. Now, I thought when I looked at it, Ginger's in trouble here. This could be an Epstein moment. Until I saw on social media, of course, the whole picture. And at the edge of the actual picture is Prince William, the anointed one. Prince William, he of such even temper, he of such sober ways, he's in the picture with the pervert P. Diddy and Ginger Prince Harry. But the British newspapers cut Harry out of the picture. It doesn't suit their narrative, you see, for William to be in a picture that might prove embarrassing. How about that then? That's, of course, only one of 1,000 examples that I could give you, some of which include ourselves. I was contacted by a now online, shall I call it a newspaper? An online publication called The Independent. Ha! Ha! And asked if I had given an interview to a Russian newspaper. They gave me the name of the newspaper and asked me, had I been paid for giving that interview to a newspaper? Now, leave aside that I didn't even know you could get paid for giving interviews to newspapers. I had never heard of this Russian newspaper. I never gave them any interview. I have never given an interview to any Russian newspaper. And The Independent's owned by a Russian whose father was the KGB resident in London. Don't ask me how I know that, or I'd have to kill you. The KGB resident is the joint owner of The Independent, whose journalist wrote a very, very long, I fell asleep during the reading of it, witch hunt attack on me, in which it was in his mind, though never made it to the page, that I had A, given this interview, and B, might have been paid for it. I pointed out to him, Archie, his name was, it's you who was getting paid by the Russians. Well, a Russian, now a member of the House of Lords, as it happens. And he's best buddies with Boris Johnson, as it happens. And Boris Johnson used to slip his MI6 security detail to go and stay at the apparently luxurious residence of that Russian owner of The Independent. This is how low these people are. A journalist receiving payment from a Russian newspaper magnate attacks me for not giving an interview to a Russian newspaper and alleging that I might have been paid for it. All that happened, as the discerning viewer would quickly ascertain, was that the speech I gave in my monologue on Sunday was written down by, amongst others, this Russian newspaper. They seen it on YouTube, and they quoted it extensively on YouTube. Ah, if only I'd known, I could have been paid for it. But enough of these repulsive gutter snipes who slither in the sewer in the name of British journalism. More important issues must now be dealt with. The United Nations Security Council finally passed a resolution by 14 votes to zero, with one abstention, to which I shall come, demanding an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Not a total ceasefire. Not a ceasefire that will last necessarily beyond the end of Ramadan, which is more than 2 weeks, but not much more than 2 weeks. So it passed a resolution demanding a ceasefire. It's mandatory, by the way, despite what some have tried ludicrously to claim. When the Security Council passes a resolution, it is mandatory on the object, subject of that resolution to comply with the decision of the United Nations Security Council. They passed it. Nobody voted against it. But there's no ceasefire. Israel has stepped up the massacre. They are killing more people than they were killing before the resolution was passed. They're massacring people in tents in Rafah right now. They're massacring people in the Al-Shifa hospital, in a hospital right now. They're massacring people who come out to get food aid, which, amongst others, has been dropped from the sky by the aforementioned David Cameron and the British government. The British government wants credit for dropping food to starving Palestinians in Gaza, but is selling weapons to the people who then massacred the people who came out to collect the food that was landing. Hopefully not upon them, because several people were killed with these crates falling on top of them. Several Palestinians were drowned trying to get to the crates dropped into the sea. When there's thousands of aid trucks outside the gate of Rafah that could be opened and the trucks could come in and without let or hindrance distribute the aid all through the Gaza Strip. So here's my point. Now that the Security Council has demanded a ceasefire and Israel has refused to comply, what happens next? And if nothing happens next, then what is the point of the United Nations Security Council? What is the point of all the money we spend on it if it can pass a resolution that is then completely ignored, defied, without consequence? And I got to thinking, why single out the United Nations Security Council? What about all the other agencies, sinews of the international rules-based order? How are they doing? How is the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, the ICC, doing in his investigation of the manifest war crimes, crimes against humanity, plausibly including the ultimate crime of genocide? How is he doing? Mr. Khan, his name is, he's British, Mr. Khan. He's the head prosecutor of the ICC. He has not even published an indictment, an arrest, made a charge, never mind bringing anybody to justice in The Hague. He has not charged a single person in 6 months of carnage, which his colleagues also in The Hague at the International Court of Justice have said is plausibly genocide. and sent Israel for trial on the crime of genocide. And whatever happened to the International Court of Justice? I may have been dreaming, but I am sure that by a huge landslide majority, the ICJ sent Israel for trial, required a report from Israel within 30 days as to how they were complying with this ruling, and ordered Israel to stop killing Palestinian civilians in Gaza. Did Israel stop? No, they redoubled the killing in Gaza. Did the ICJ do anything about it? No, nothing at all. Which all vindicates what I said at the time when the ICC was founded, that these agencies, these apparatus pieces of the so-called rules-based order are just lipstick on a pig. The pig is the war pig of NATO and Western imperial power, war after war, war throughout the world. But you've got the lipstick that you can put on to pretend that it's all so civilized. But when push comes to shove, the lipstick is washed off, wiped off, smeared off, and the killing goes on and on and on. Now, do you remember that guy, barbecue, eating a human being in an act of cannibalism on the news in Haiti just the other week? No, I don't either. I just recall that some people said so. But then, as Malcolm X said, if you're not careful, the media will have you hating the oppressed and loving the oppressors. Nowhere more true than in the story of Haiti, coming up with the one and only Dan Cohen after this short break. Stay tuned.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Now, Dan Cohen is not just a journalist. He's in the very premier league of journalists and analysts and broadcasters. But he likes to be called a journalist, and he can be found at Uncaptured News. And he likes you to watch his films too. And as one who's watched them, I can tell you, he's always worth watching. He's Dan Cohen, and he joins us now. Dan, thank you for joining the Mother of All Talk Shows again. I want to talk to you about Haiti, which we covered quite intensively a couple of years ago, maybe a little less, and then it moved out of the news. But it's right back up there, especially in your country of the United States. If you'll forgive the pun, what's cooking there?
Well, that cannibalism disinformation campaign that you referenced earlier was part of just that, a disinformation campaign to pave the way for a military invasion of Haiti that the United States for about 3 years has been seeking to orchestrate. And now the Washington's desire to see this go down is at really a fever pitch. Now we're seeing op-eds in the Washington Post and the Financial Times calling for a direct U.S. military invasion of Haiti. And I use the term invasion and not intervention because nobody in Haiti has agreed to this, has asked for a foreign military or foreign force to come into their country. It's completely illegal. There's no basis for it. And the figure who the U.S. wants to take out is who you referenced before, Jimmy Cherizier, whose nickname is Barbecue, the former police officer who has revolutionary aspirations and is trying to change his country for the better. And so naturally, that's who the U.S. wants to eliminate.
What could possibly go wrong, Dan? We've been through this play before, haven't we?
Well, repeatedly, the U.S. has invaded Haiti, violated its sovereignty countless times through history, I think 5 times in the last century. And the last, the UN intervention lasted for, 13 years, from 2004 to 2017. So it was just 6-7 years ago that foreign forces, military forces, pulled out of Haiti. And now the U.S. wants to send them back. But this time, I think it would be much worse than it was before. I mean, the track record of what happened in that period under the MINUSTAH occupation was horrible. Massacres, rape of children. There are now fatherless children in Port-au-Prince who were born by children. There was a cholera outbreak that killed many thousands of people. And that was all under the purview of the United Nations. Those were blue helmets. Now the United Nations Security Council has given its blessing to a force that the United States is orchestrating, led primarily by Kenyan police forces. Now, the Kenyan police forces are notoriously brutal. A 2009 United Nations report by the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights found the existence of death squads in the Kenyan police, and those have basically been reshuffled every couple of years ever since, and they still exist to this day. So supposed to combat supposed gang violence in Haiti, the United States proposes to send much more violent gangs and, in fact, death squads that would operate with total impunity to basically kill a popular leader.
Now, what they call death gangs, you call revolution. So help our viewers with this. Tell us about this fellow nicknamed Barbecue, what he's done, what social forces are behind him, and what his program for that revolution would be.
Well, basically, Barbecue is a former police officer. He was in an anti-gang unit in the Haitian National Police, and the United States wanted to destabilize the government of President Jovenel Moise back in 2019 because he was starting to turn away from the unipolar U.S.-led order. So basically, they took an incident that Barbecue was involved in as a police officer. And there was a firefight between the police and a criminal arms group in which people were killed. It went awry. However, the principal NED-funded human rights group in Haiti suddenly called this a massacre, and the disinformation machine went along with it, rolled out and started smearing him. That pushed him out of the police, and he basically dedicated himself to revolution at that point. And so he defended his neighborhood from criminal armed groups. He expelled rapists and kidnappers and the like, and began to basically tell the different neighborhoods that had armed groups, that had weapons, and even the ones that had criminals that he was battling against, let's stop fighting and let's join forces in order to have a revolution against the oligarchs that give us these weapons and give us this ammunition to kill each other. And so he's been trying to do that for years, and all these years, and we show it in the documentary, Another Vision, which you can see at anothervisionhaiti.com. All this time, as he's fighting very fierce battles against criminals from the lower classes, he's trying to basically unite all of them. And so finally, he successfully did that. And that is the group called Vivre Ensemble, is a coalition of armed groups, some of which are involved in criminal activity and some of which are completely against criminal activity, as it like barbecue. And that Vivre Ensemble coalition was able to, when the de facto prime minister, Ariel Henry, the U.S. puppet, went to Kenya on February 27th in order to sign a bilateral agreement to have this Kenyan force come into Haiti, this armed group coalition went and attacked the airport so he could not return. And they basically forced his resignation. So all of a sudden, these armed groups that have a spotty record, and some of which have actually terrorized the population, as they suddenly got rid of this puppet prime minister. And so the masses see basically that this armed group, this armed coalition, has accomplished the immediate demand of getting rid of the puppet. And so now the U.S. wants to bring the forces in to kill him. And one last point, you asked about his social program. Well, if you go into Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier's neighborhood of Lower Delma, you will see that there is no trash on the ground, unlike the rest of Port-au-Prince. You will see there is clean water. There is food for people to eat. There is security. You know, you can walk around at any time at night and be perfectly fine, unlike the other neighborhoods of Port-au-Prince. So really, he has a revolutionary program in his neighborhood that he wants to extend throughout the country.
And will this new invasion, for that's what it would be, will this new invasion be contested by these armed groups? And will we therefore have a state of war with the Kenyan police fighting for the West?
Well, Jimmy Cherizier Barbecue has pledged that he would fight these Kenyan death squads in the event that they come in, or any other foreign force, to the last drop of blood, because he says we have Dessalines' blood in our veins, Dessalines being the founding father of Haiti. And so there's no doubt that it would be a very fierce battle. It would be very bad for everyone involved, for all parties involved. It would be a bloodbath. It would not go well for these Kenyan forces who do not speak Creole. They don't know the language. They, of course, don't know the lay of the land. And they are, frankly, at this point, the United States has only been able to come up with 400 Kenyan forces because they have such a criminal record among them. It's a very small force at this point, and Washington is running out of options. And that's why we see in the last 2 days these op-eds in the Washington Post and the Financial Times saying that the U.S. just has to do it directly. So there have been, I would say, unconfirmed reports of some kind of U.S. military presence off of Haiti's coast. But soon the U.S. is going to seek one way or another to get some kind of military force into Haiti to stamp out this alliance of armed groups led by Jimmy Cherizier.
And what first attracted the American empire to the poor little place called Haiti?
Well, I mean, if we go back, you know, to the Haitian Revolution, really, so the 1791 to 1804 revolution is when it finalized. And the United States always basically saw this revolution of slaves as a threat. And there were Haitians involved, Haitian revolutionaries involved in slave uprisings in the United States and throughout the Americas. And ever since, the United States has sought to subdue Haiti, including a 34-year occupation beginning in 1915, when the United States Marines went into Haiti and simply stole its gold reserves from the central bank. and has imposed dictatorships, coup d'etats, neoliberal economics on Haiti ever since in order to keep it down and prevent it from prevent Haitians from actually benefiting from their own labor and from the riches of their own country, of which there are many. And so that is basically the equation that exists today.
Are they afraid of another Cuba?
Absolutely. You can imagine that State Department planners here in Washington, D.C. are terrified of the idea of a twin revolutionary island nation just east across the Windward Passage from Cuba, because, of course, there could be some kind of effect with other countries, too. Imagine what could happen in the Dominican Republic or in Puerto Rico, where there's a strong independence sentiment among its nationalist sector, and Venezuela is just to the south. So the idea of the United States losing another neo-colony in Latin America and the Caribbean is terrifying, especially in the era of the new Cold War with China, in which the United States is pulling its sweatshops. U.S. corporations are pulling their sweatshops out of Southeast Asia, out of China, and relocating them back into the Western Hemisphere, and sees Haiti as the place that it can exploit the most. And it is traditionally, for decades, has been the place where the U.S. has enforced the lowest wages, the most brutal exploitation, and it wants to maintain that in order to keep cheap products coming into the United States.
Remind us, Dan, where can people see your film on Haiti?
I've just uploaded it to a site called anothervisionhaiti.com. So if you just go to anothervisionhaiti.com, all three episodes are linked there. The site is very basic. I'm going to improve it, but they're all there. You can also see it on my YouTube channel, Uncaptured Media. Also on Rumble. I've just uploaded it on Rumble to my Rumble channel, Uncaptured Media. So any of those three places. I think the easiest thing is anothervisionhaiti.com.
I'm sure we'll all be doing that. Dan Cohen, as always, thanks for joining us on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Let me take a quick break, and then it's your calls all the way to the hour. I'm gobsmacked by this poll. I'm trying to get my head around it. See you in a minute.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Jackson Hinkle is one of the brightest stars in the firmament. I think he's back in the United States, but he has been spending time around the world, in the Arab world, in Russia. He's garnering a worldwide reputation as well as a worldview that is practically second to none, certainly in the United States. And I'm glad to say he's back with us now on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Jackson, my condolences to the American people on the tragedy in Baltimore. It either looks like the Baltimore Bridge was in such a parlous state that it folded like a cheap tent, killing the workers that were on top of it, and I don't know, maybe even some motorists that were driving over it, or something more sinister. What's your take on that?
Well, I'll get to that in a second. I first want to say thanks for having me on the show again, and thank you for everything that you're doing in the UK, because as a young communist in America, it's very inspiring to see your victory and everything that the Workers' Party of Great Britain is doing. I'm just so happy, and I will fully endorse George Galloway for prime minister and get rid of the Zionist in office who's currently occupying it. But as for the events in Maryland, it was a travesty, of course. I find it interesting that, you know, we as American citizens are told by our government and by the media that we are conspiracy theorists if we ask any questions about, you know, mass devastating events like the one we saw unfold this week. You know, the media is telling us that it was just a natural disaster. Nothing should be asked of it, just like they're talking about the events in Moscow this week. We're not allowed to ask any questions. We're supposed to believe that ISIS was responsible. And I think that's frankly un-American. We're supposed to be able to have free speech. We're supposed to be able to ask questions about what's going down. And as you mentioned, regardless of whether there was nefarious actors involved in the collapse of the bridge, what is a sure thing is that that bridge was in a very poor state of affairs, like much of the infrastructure across the United States. And that's been one of the biggest takeaways that I've noticed in traveling across the world. You mentioned I've been in Russia, I've been in China, I've been in Morocco. Our infrastructure in the United States is abysmal, and it's insane to me that we continue to funnel money abroad to Israel, to Ukraine and other countries when our country's in such shambles.
Now, they were not sure how this disaster in Maryland happened, but they were very sure that Ukraine was not involved in the mass murder in Moscow, and that not only Islamists, but a named Islamist group, Special K, ISIS-K, within hours, not only the governments of the West, but all of their teat-sucking, servile, sycophantic journalists were absolutely adamant that it was a crime committed by ISIS-K. And as you may not know, we're running a poll, a gigantic poll. A clear effort was made on Twitter, but not on the other platforms. They didn't realize we had other platforms where actually far more votes are cast. A huge effort was made involving tens of thousands of accounts to persuade us that it was ISIS and not Ukraine. Further evidence, you might think, of this rush to point over there at a helpful set of malcontents and murderers in ISIS. How were we so quick? How are we so sure in Western countries that this was done not by Ukraine, and therefore by extension us, but was in fact done by some Tajiks who don't know the right hand from the left hand when they're swearing on the Quran and standing in front of their child's paint box ISIS banner? Why were we so sure, and for what purpose?
It's a very serious issue, but I'm laughing because it's insane that anyone would believe that these individuals who committed this terror attack were acting, you know, on their own. There's no reason for these extremists to have committed this attack against Russia on their own. There's no qui bono, as they put it, for them to have done this. Who benefits? It doesn't make sense. The only people who benefited from this attack are the West and Ukraine. And there is ample evidence that Ukraine and by proxy, the United States were the organizers of this horrific event. I mean, the individuals who committed this attack were fleeing into Ukraine. They were caught in the Bryansk region. In addition to that, the United States has come out day after day saying and making sure that everyone knows it was not them. It was not the CIA who had any involvement in this. But we saw the Russian security services come out this week and say that Ukraine, the UK, and the United States were behind this deadly attack. So the United States and the CIA have committed tons of terror attacks on Russia, not just this year, not just last year, but for decades now. Obviously, they benefit. Obviously, they have a history of doing this. And again, I think it's important to ask questions as to who actually organized this attack. Now, you bring up the important fact that the United States has said that ISIS-K was the only group involved in this attack, and they were the ones who organized it and committed it. The only problem with that is everyone who has at least two working brain cells knows that the United States created ISIS, armed ISIS, supported ISIS, provided medical support for ISIS when the U.S. and the U.K. were operating a dirty war in Syria against Bashar al-Assad. So regardless of whether we want to take the official U.S. line or the official Russian line, it does seem as though the United States has ample culpability behind this terror attack.
Quite so. As I said earlier, it's actually even more interesting if it really was ISIS-K. Because then we need to start asking, who are these people? How did they come to be? Where did they get the weapons? Where did they get the money? And why did they do this at this moment in time? The only people that have been attacked by this so-called ISIS-K are Russia and Iran, with some attempts made against China. In other words, the big three in the United States and UK's official enemy list. That's a remarkable coincidence, isn't it?
It is. And President Putin brought up that point as well. He said, ISIS generally only ever attacks the official enemies of the U.S. government. And he said, I find that very interesting. And it is interesting. Of course, we can look back to the one time when ISIS accidentally launched a missile at Israel when ISIS was fighting in Syria. And that was the only time that ISIS ever apologized to anybody, to any state actor, to any civilian population. They apologized to Israel for accidentally launching a missile at their country. When it comes to the events that you mentioned, the attack on Iran, I believe what you're referring to was the attack on the memorial procession commemorating the loss of life, the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, who, of course, was a feared villain in the eyes of the official State Department and Pentagon actors. They killed him during the Trump administration. So it's very clear is that, not only are just random enemies of the U.S. being targeted by this ISIS-K group, but the most feared villains of them all in the eyes of the West are the ones who are being attacked.
Yes, an extraordinary coincidence, one of many to which I'm sure we will return. Now, you mentioned Donald Trump there. In the last few days, Biden's policy of everlasting, never-ending, bottomless support for the Israeli government and its slaughter of the innocents in Gaza has plummeted in its levels of support amongst the United States. That's evident. Only 18% of Democratic voters support what Israel is doing, which spells big trouble for Biden. But it's not just that part of America that's falling out of love with Israel, is it? We've had the extraordinary phenomenon of Candace Owens, a figure from the right, formerly of The Wire, Alex Jones, another figure from the right, Tucker Carlson, another figure from the right, and now Donald Trump warning Israel that it is losing its friends all over the world, and that it has to bring this war to a speedy conclusion. That's quite a turn of events, isn't it, Jackson?
It is. And I'd also add that this morning, a new podcast between Joe Rogan and Kurt Metzger, one of the featured main guests on the Jimmy Dore show, during that podcast, Joe Rogan came out and called what is happening in Gaza a genocide against the people of Gaza. And he had some other very harsh words for Israel as well, of condemnation. I do think that it's most interesting what Donald Trump had to say. I've often referred to him as Zion Don, and others have as well, because of his longstanding deep support for Israel. But something interesting happened at the end of his presidential administration, he came out and was very upset with Benjamin Netanyahu for some reasons that I'm not sure YouTube will allow us to discuss. But he was very upset with him. And it seems as though there's been a lasting impact on Donald Trump ever since. And now you're seeing him come out and say that the world is turning against Israel. He wished that he had called Israel and told them not to do this because it was going to be very bad. He said, I've been watching all the photos and the videos coming out night after night of bombs being dropped on civilian homes. He said, this has to end. We need peace. So whether or not this is just an election ploy, I don't know. But it is definitely the correct line that needs to be taken for any candidate for any office in the federal government in the United States at this point. And he is the only one who's even coming close to taking a line of condemnation against Israel. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., full supporter of Israel. Joe Biden, same, so on and so forth with all the other candidates. Donald Trump is the only major candidate that is coming out right now and saying these things. The last point I'll make, you brought up all these right-wing names like Candace Owens, Donald Trump. I've mentioned Joe Rogan. You mentioned Tucker Carlson. Don't you find it interesting that all of these individuals in the United States, and you could say yourself in the United Kingdom, were some of the most viral voices online, some of the most followed voices online. We've all thought long, hard, and critically about the events taking place in Gaza, and have come to the conclusion that there needs to be a stark condemnation of Israel. And because of that, we've all found ourselves in positions where we have to be independent online in our shows and our programs. No mainstream media outlets will ever think about hiring us, and they just fired Tucker and Candace. I think that says a lot about the state of our media and also about our governments, that no one wants to issue any condemnation of Israel.
Yes, it does. But it also speaks volumes about where the public are at, because you just became, was it 2.5 million followers you've got now on Twitter? Phenomenal number. Yes. And I may even have understated it. You'll tell me, I'm sure. Tucker Carlson's numbers are exponentially greater than they were before he was fired. 3 million people watched Moats in the last 7 days. Your numbers are rocketing. So the public are going out to look for us. And sometimes, in your case, they've got to look pretty hard for you. But they're doing it because the appetite of the public for the truth is pretty much insatiable.
Yes, and that's exactly why you just won your election, because you're willing to speak truth to power on so many issues, especially and including the issue of Gaza and what's unfolding there. I think that, of course, it shows that we are all over the target, directly over the target, considering the fact that since October 7th, I've been banned from YouTube, WhatsApp. I've been banned this week from Instagram and Facebook. Meta took my pages down with 500,000 followers. And now only can you find me on X with 2.5 million followers. I think it does show, though, like you said, that when you have a sense of meritocracy, when those who have the most rational messages who are allowed to speak freely and are not censored, they will, in fact, rise to the top and more people will follow them. You, I believe you just hit 400,000 on YouTube. You're surpassed 700,000 on X. People are seeking out the truth, regardless of how difficult it is becoming to find.
Yeah, my new ambition is to catch up with you on X, but take it from me, and I mean this sincerely, my heart swelled with pride for you when I saw that number. I love you like a son. Jackson Hinkle, thanks for joining us on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Always a pleasure to have you on the show. Who was behind the Moscow attack? Was it ISIS or was it Ukraine? Well, so far, out of 63,411 votes cast, only 5% of the Telegram audience think that it was ISIS. 95% think it was Ukraine. On the YouTube community poll, only 15% think it was ISIS. 85% think it was Ukraine. On the YouTube stream, only 8% think it was ISIS. 92% think it was Ukraine. But on Twitter, it's 76% say it was ISIS and 24% say it was Ukraine. Now, if that doesn't tell you something, then I'm not sure there's much more I can do for you. Although, stay tuned, because on Julian Assange and many other things, the Honourable Craig Murray, former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, and now court reporter extraordinaire, and many other things, will tell us what happened with Julian Assange this week. Stay tuned.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Our next guest, who is the Honourable Craig Murray, former British ambassador and a historian, as well as an activist, and perhaps most pertinently, in the context of this interview, a man who's followed the Julian Assange case and all of its twists and turns. Craig, thanks for joining us, especially as you've got your arm in a sling. I'm grateful to you. I don't know if you heard that last call. The gentleman that we don't know, I don't know, Stephen in London, thought that Julian might be permitted to introduce a private bill into Parliament that would somehow spring him. One thing's for sure, while he didn't get out yesterday, you could argue that he might be on that plane to the United States in 3 weeks from now if the Americans give assurances that won't be worth the paper that they're written on, but may be enough to persuade the establishment stooges in wigs sitting on the bench. What say you?
I think you know, there's a long history of the United States giving diplomatic assurances which they don't keep, both to the United Kingdom and to other countries, as regards the treatment of prisoners, as regard conditions of trial, as regard charges to be brought. But the assurances will be accepted, whatever assurances are given. They're going to have difficulty giving assurances on the point of whether or not he will be allowed to rely on the First Amendment as a foreign national, because that's up to the judge. And nobody can assure what a judge is going to decide. And as Julian's defense case put forward in his application for an appeal, and as the judgment refers to, there is a Supreme Court judgment which states that foreign nationals acting abroad, and Julian, of course, was foreign national acting abroad at the time he published these documents, are not entitled to any constitutional protections. And one of the reasons given in that Supreme Court judgment, one of the reasons given for that, is that if foreign nationals acting abroad were entitled to constitutional protections, then the United States military would have to grant constitutional rights to enemy combatants with whom they were in contact. Meaning, of course, that the people in Guantanamo Bay, for example, would have constitutional rights. So that there are complex reasons why the Americans are going to be both unable and unwilling to give an assurance on the grounds of no discrimination against him on the grounds of nationality, on the grounds that he would be allowed to plead the First Amendment, because it's not by any means plain that he would be allowed to plead the First Amendment.
And the US government is not in a position to give that assurance, even if they were minded. I'm on the same page as you. I think that's by far the most onerous of the three conditions that the British judges have sent to Washington. and could actually scupper the trial, couldn't it? If they refuse to give those assurances, or at least that one assurance, the judges yesterday said that Julian would have a high chance of success in an appeal. And therefore, we could, mightn't we, be coming towards the end of this long calvary of our friend Julian Assange?
It's a possibility. But, I mean, so many legal points have been twisted on the way here that I don't in the least rule out they're twisting this particular point out of the way as well. What we might see is an assurance given, but simply an assurance that the prosecution will not seek to argue that he does not have First Amendment protections. But that doesn't mean that the judge won't rule it anyway. But the court may decide to accept simply an assurance that the prosecution will not seek it. And I mean, when you bear in mind that one of the things yesterday's judgment says is that it accepts that there were senior American officials from the president down and the secretary of state down saying that they wanted Julian to be killed, and there were plots being hatched to plans to kidnap him or to assassinate him. But then they say, but that's okay, because if he's extradited, they won't need to kidnap him or assassinate him. Therefore, they can be trusted. You know, when you look at the twisted logic of that, saying, well, we're putting him into their power so they won't need to kill him, as opposed to we're putting him into the power of people who want to kill him, they could well find a way to twist logic around this. I've never believed at any stage of this that any legal argument is so strong that our supine judgments won't find a way to give way to the United States.
Unless the United States doesn't actually want him back, Craig, in an election year at the very least.
Yeah, that's exactly what I think is happening here. This achieves everything that the United States wanted from this result. It keeps Julian in a maximum security prison. And as you and I are talking, Julian is there in the most terrible hellhole that is a Belmarsh prison, where both his physical and his mental health are deteriorating measurably on a daily basis. So that's achieved for them by this. It knocks everything a couple of months away. The United States want Julian dead, or if not dead, they want him in a concrete tomb, completely isolated, where he might as well be dead, where he's effectively dead. That's what their objective. But their objective is not to get there before the election, as you quite rightly say. Biden is already in huge trouble getting re-elected. The Genocide Joe label has stuck and has deservedly stuck. Whole elements of the coalition that supports him, particularly the black and other ethnic minority votes and young people's votes, are deserting him in massive droves due to the genocide in Gaza and his active support and complicity in that genocide. And those are exactly the same people who are going to be outraged by the persecution of Julian Assange if Julian Assange appears in chains in Washington. So Biden can't afford for him to turn up. So the whole thing is being kicked further down the road. That's why they granted these very limited grounds of possible appeal. That's why they gave the United States more time. That's why we have a new term table of several more months, which then may lead to an eventual hearing on the point we've been discussing. And that will all put it comfortably past the US election with Julian still in maximum security prison. So that's exactly what this is all about.
May I turn in the few minutes left, and I'm grateful for your time, to your former career as a diplomat. I want to put it to you that when the Security Council demands a ceasefire, and this demand is not just ignored, but defied with an intensification of the murder of the Palestinian people, that this renders the Security Council, the United Nations, and international diplomacy in general an utterly ridiculous, pathetic, crestfallen being, doesn't it?
It does. I would have to agree with that. And you have a situation where the United States is making claims that a Security Council resolution is non-binding, which is absolute nonsense. You know, it's just talking total gibberish in international law, as in fact both the Chinese and the Russians, and in fact more or less every other member of the Security Council apart from the United Kingdom has since said. It is just simply untrue to say a Security Council resolution is not binding. What it isn't is a Chapter 7 resolution, which mandates the use of force and mandates the use of sanctions. And that has to be the next move. If the Security Council doesn't, and the whole United Nations system doesn't want to look utterly impotent, it has now to move to a Chapter 7 resolution imposing sanctions on Israel and perhaps authorizing the use of military force to bring to an end the situation in Gaza. And that will very much depend, frankly, on the role of major powers like China and Russia and being willing to push that. It will also lead to further use of the United States veto, which, of course, will show us exactly who is promoting and protecting Palestine. Sorry, who is promoting and protecting genocide in Palestine, and we'll lead to further isolation.
But it would be a stark, it would be a stark exposure indeed. Hope to see you back in Blighty, up in the northwest soon, Craig Murray. Thank you for joining us on the Mother of All Talk Shows, Craig Murray, historian, former British ambassador, human rights activist. Remember, don't forget now about the podcast. You can download this show as a podcast anytime you like. Just scan that QR code on your screen now. Last call is from Zahid in Manchester. Welcome, Zahid. You're the last call of the evening.
Hello, George. You okay?
By the grace of God, I'm good. Thank you very much.
Just wanted to say congratulations and thank you so much for your work and really appreciate all of your efforts for the years that you've done what you've done. Unfortunately, there's not many people like you. Just wanted to say thank you so much. And it's an honor sort of listening to you and allowing you to tell us what's really happening and what's really going on out there.
How beautiful. What a beautiful, beautiful call and message. Zahid, we'll be fighting almost all, if not all, of the parliamentary seats in Manchester at the general election. A good friend of mine, Shabazz, is already running in the local elections in the Longsight ward. I think we've got covered all the other Manchester seats, but maybe one or two. But the seven Labour MPs in Manchester who remain friends of Israel, or as I call them, fiends of Israel, be sure the Workers' Party is coming for you. I've got only time for 30 seconds of comment. If I was in any doubt that the deep state, you know, the one that Prime Minister Liz Truss told us about when she was over in America a couple of weeks ago, conspiracy theorist. Well, she was the British Prime Minister. She was brought down. So maybe she knows a thing or two about what she called the deep state. If I had any doubts that the deep state want you to believe that it was ISIS that carried out the mass murder in Moscow, the attempt to rig our poll, record poll, here on the Mother of All Talk Shows this evening, removes forever any doubt at all. Go figure, as the Americans would say. I'll be back, of course, God willing, on Sunday with the Mothership, the Sunday edition of the Mother of All Talk Shows. Our guests will be as good as the excellent guests were this evening. What a lineup. What a show. What calls. What records are broken. It really is the mother of all talk shows.